This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So it's not that peak oil means we're going to run out of petroleum. It means that we're going to run out of petroleum as we know it.
Last week on Sea Change Radio, we discussed the Chevron refinery in Richmond, California, and the social movement that's pushing back against one of the world's largest corporations there. This week, we hear from Roger Kim, the executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, a nonprofit that enables disenfranchised communities to fight for social justice. Then, I talk with Greg Karras, a scientist from Communities for a Better Environment, about the adaptations oil refineries are making as we hit and pass peak oil, and how these changes will affect the health of the planet.
I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Roger Kim. He's the executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. Roger, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
It says on your APEN, the Asian Pacific Environmental Network's website, it says your mission is uniting Asian and Pacific Islander communities for environmental and social justice. Now, how does the Richmond refinery, the Chevron refinery in Richmond, California, play a role in that? And why is APEN involved in it?
Well, when we were starting up the organization back in 1993, we were looking to bring the Asian immigrant and refugee community to the environmental justice movement and bring that community also into the social justice movement. And Richmond really stood out as one of the places where there needed to be organizing, particularly in our community. Richmond is home to one of the largest Laotian refugee populations in the country, brought to that city, as a result of the involvement of the U.S. in the Vietnam War. As they were closing down refugee camps in Thailand, Richmond was one of the resettlement points, and mainly because of the cheap housing that existed in that city. Part of the reason that the housing is so cheap is because of the industrial pollution that exists in the city of Richmond, including the Chevron refinery, which is one of the biggest sources of pollution in the community.
And when was the Chevron refinery built? Give us a little bit more of a history of the refinery, if you can step back even further.
Sure. The refinery's been in its current location for over 100 years, actually. So it's been there for quite a while, and the city of Richmond kind of grew up around it, along with the port there in Richmond. And it actually was a place where they were doing a lot of the shipbuilding during World War II. And so, when they were bringing in labor from other parts of the country, particularly African Americans from the South, they were put into neighborhoods that were redlined and, neighborhoods that were predominantly segregated for poor working black folk. And so there's been a long history of kind of racial segregation, neighborhood segregation as a part of the history of Richmond that kind of grew up around the Chevron refinery. And that's one of the lasting legacies of how land use happened around the refinery that resulted in this real mix of pollution along with poor people, next to a really very polluting facility.
And what are the resources that these people are able to tap into to try to fight the seemingly limitless pockets of a Chevron?
People have hope. People have incredible courage and resolve. incredible inspiration from each other, you know, to take on one of the biggest corporations in the world, the biggest corporation in the state of California, you know, the biggest source of pollution in industrial source of pollution in the region. You know, it takes a lot of courage. And that's what our members tap into. It's not only working with our community, but also joining forces with other communities, the African-American community, the Latino community, the white community, and rising up and taking on a big corporation like Chevron. It also takes a national and an international movement to connect to help build that kind of courage and solidarity. So, you know, we're linked into other communities that are fighting struggles against refineries like Chevron across the country and also around the world. So when we were able to stop the expansion of the Chevron refinery here in Richmond, you know, congratulations messages came in from all over the world, including our friends in Nigeria who were also fighting Chevron pollution over there. So it's not only are we inspired by them, but they were inspired by us in this particular moment.
So give us a snapshot of the progress that's been made in the fight by your organization and your allies.
Well, you know, when Chevron first came forward with this project to basically build the infrastructure to refine much dirtier, heavier oil in Richmond, it was a struggle that we knew that we had to take on because of the impact that that refinery was already having. People of color comprised 72 to 94% of the population in the neighborhoods that surround the refinery. The fence line is with the refinery is, you know, predominantly low-income people of color. There are two elementary schools, a park, a municipal within a mile of the refinery. And, you know, there's just an incredible amount of pollution that comes out, especially deadly pollutants that are 40 times the statewide average. You know, our incidence of air quality incidence is 14 times higher than it is in the rest of the Bay Area. So it has a huge, huge impact on people that are living around the refinery, people who are literally paying with their lives so that, you know, people can have gasoline to drive in their cars. And, you know, what I say of that is, you know, we've set up a system that relies heavily on fossil fuels in many ways that's been subsidized by our own public dollars to make that system, you know, viable and survive. And, you know, we're at a point where not only are the health impacts, the social impacts of that that system becoming more apparent, we see that system is not going to be able to survive in the current form that it is. And so what we need to do is actually begin to move towards other sources of energy that are actually going to be cleaner, healthier, renewable, and also make sure that it's taking care of, you know, communities like our community and helping to promote and develop our communities as well.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Roger Kim. He's the executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network. Roger, you just cited some pollution statistics that separates Richmond from the rest of the Bay Area. Can you give us an idea of the health impact of that pollution?
You know, we have a toxic soup of air that's really literally not fit to breathe. We've got abnormally high and serious health impacts as a result of it. Rates of asthma and other respiratory illnesses are off the charts. People, including our members who live downwind from the refinery, that experience dizziness, headaches, rashes following, you know, dangerous releases of chemical gases from the refinery. Those are serious, serious conditions that people are forced to deal with. And not only is the outdoor air polluted, but we are also finding that indoor air is actually much, pollution is higher in houses around the refinery than it is in other houses as well. So this is just not a very, not a safe environment for, certainly not for kids to be growing up next to a refinery.
And now that you can look back and with success on your efforts to stop the expansion of the refinery to be able to refine dirtier fuel, what is next for your organization? We hear about tar sands coming to California. Is that on your radar?
Sure. We know that this kind of infrastructure that Chevron is trying to build, the ability to refine heavier and dirtier oil, is infrastructure that oil refineries across the country are trying to do. And it's not only a result of increasingly dirtier sources of oil like tar sands, but also as the quote-unquote lighter, sweeter oil that isn't as thick and gooey is becoming more rare, and we're getting to the bottom of the wells. You know, the oil is much dirtier that needs to be processed. So, and that includes things like sources like tar sands. So, you know, we're continuing to track that and make sure that this particular refinery is you know, not going to be able to expand in the way that they're going to try to expand it. In the meantime, we want to promote solutions in the community. So, you know, we're doing work, for example, in expanding the reach of solar renewable energy into low-income communities, and with Richmond as a prime example of where we think that kind of energy production makes a lot of sense. So we're working on a bill right now that's making its way through the California State Legislature, AB 1990, called Solar for All, that would actually help build solar renewable energy in low-income communities, and also make sure that those communities are getting the jobs that are related to that kind of those kinds of projects. You know, as we're kind of on the front end of a growing green economy, we need to make sure that the benefits of that economy are also reaching the folks who have basically borne the brunt of the dirty economy, and we think that is one particular solution that is really, really worth advocating for.
The executive director of the Asian Pacific Environmental Network, Roger Kim. Roger, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
I'm joined now by Greg Karas. He's a senior scientist at Communities for a Better Environment. Greg, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. It's great to be here.
How did it get built, the Richmond refinery, and is there any chance that these refineries can get relocated?
So refineries are in general, and in Richmond are, they're unique in a couple ways. It's cheaper to transport the oil than the product when the heavy oil is broken down into lighter gasoline, it expands. So maybe 10% less tanker trips from Saudi Arabia. If you refine it here, for example, they tend to be built near water because of the shipping. They tend to be built near places that have hills, so there can be gravity drainage from the tankage to the process units. Those things are somewhat unique to the oil industry, but otherwise it's the same problem that you have competition for land resources, just like we have competition for money resources when we're talking about what kind of energy system to build and whether to build alternative energy. So the challenge and the opportunity in Richmond and in other communities like this are that our land has unique value, and our local governments have land use authority. We can say, look, we want to be moving over time towards greener, more jobs intensive industries on our land. And for those industries that are still here and will be, like refineries, for at least a decade or two, whether we like it or not, we want them to be state-of-the-art and moving in the right direction and helping us to build that greener economy in the interim. So it is. It ultimately comes down to a competition for land. The people and the industry are in generally the same locations because those are the places where people want to live, where markets are created for the products, and where the kinds of things that people use, like shipping lanes, like arable land, exist.
We don't have visuals here. If you can kind of paint us a picture, so to speak, of where the refineries are concentrated in the
concentrations of refineries in the United States are first in the Texas Louisiana Gulf Coast. That's the largest concentration. There's a concentration in the Midwest. It's somewhat spread out. These are refineries that were first built to refine domestic crude. Now they're refining crude that's been piped either from Canada or from the Gulf Coast ports. There are refineries on the East Coast, not as many. Those refineries are supplemented by product pipelines from the Gulf Coast to the East Coast that send the gasoline and diesel. And then the Rocky Mountains are a major divide. There's no major pipelines or transportation of oil or product over those mountains. On the western side of the U.S., the refineries are concentrated in California and in Puget Sound. And California is roughly three-quarters of the total refining capacity west of the Rockies. In California, the refineries are concentrated in Los Angeles, and then the second largest concentration of refining capacity in the western U.S. is in here, the San Francisco Bay Area.
Let's take the perspective from the pro-oil and gas view, if you can wear that hat for a minute. I'm sure many of the proponents for expansion of refineries would say this is a way for us to offset our rising fuel needs in this country in terms of keeping the prices at an acceptable level for working Americans. Give us an idea, just a snapshot of how the U.S. being the largest refiner in the world fits into the cost at the pump in terms of the supply chain.
Well, first of all, it's really refreshing to be offered the opportunity to talk about this from the perspective of people in the industry. My friends who work in the industry, they call me up and say, I can't say this, but you know, I've spent my life working on trying to figure out how to more efficiently make the dregs of the crude into product. And there are huge challenges with that, and somebody needs to talk about it, so please publish your results in the scientific journals. It needs to be talked about. These are people who may not believe in global warming. I respect them as scientists in their field, and their field is oil. They may take it as a given that we as a human society will never be able to get away from oil, so we're just going to have to live with that. Of course, I disagree. But looking at it from that perspective, they try to figure out how to deal with the problems that are created. And in fact, on average, crude oil has been getting heavier and higher in sulfur nationwide for decades now. It's been gradual.
Similar to how we're injecting more water into the largest oil fields in Saudi Arabia and such.
Right. It's a non-renewable resource. We have, as a society, we've been burning it hard for more than a century. We've used up most of the easy-to-extract, easy-to-refine oil that we know of. And meanwhile, there's something like 150 years' supply of petroleum that in the past would not have been considered suitable.
Based on current consumption rates, that 150 years.
Based on current consumption rates, even if we don't start going to electric cars, even if China and India expand their consumption, we're looking at generations, locking in generations of fundamentally dirtier oil. So-called extra heavy oils and tar sands, these are resources that are found in huge abundance in Alberta, Canada, in parts of Venezuela, in parts of the Saudi Kuwait transition zone, in parts of Siberia, and in other parts of the world. So it's not that peak oil means we're going to run out of petroleum. It means that we're going to run out of petroleum as we know it.
Sea Change Radio is sponsored by Redwood Hill Farm, a family-owned and operated award-winning humane certified goat dairy farm and organic creamery located in Sonoma County, California. Go to redwoodhill.com to learn more about Redwood Hill Farm's extensive line of natural goat milk dairy products. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Greg Karras. He's a senior scientist at Communities for a Better Environment. There's been a bunch of articles in the last few months that are saying peak oil has been refuted, or peak oil has now been, you know, so much for the peak oil conspiracy theorists. But it's not a conspiracy when you consider that it's just everything has to have a peak when there's a finite amount of it.
Yeah, and this is a crucial point, that we have to have a conversation about what it means to be moving towards a fundamentally dirtier primary energy source with most of our investment in transportation energy. This is a conversation that has started at the front lines in the shadow of the smokestacks in places like Richmond. It's a conversation that's now taking place in perhaps in a poor form, but it's happening now nationally in the presidential campaign, in the debate over the Keystone Pipeline. It's a conversation that we have to have as a species, because best estimates are, from climate scientists across the world, that if we burn the rest of that oil, it's game over for climate protection. And because it's a human rights issue, people who live near refineries are being poisoned today. If those emissions increase by 2 to 3-fold, that human rights violation will be exacerbated dramatically. And we do have a choice. We can move, we can accelerate the movement to clean energy, to decarbonize the electric grid, and then use it for electric cars. This is the rest of the debate that's happening in the peer-reviewed climate science now. The part about what's happening at refineries that's impacting public health in this country has been covered up until now. And now we should talk about it.
We hear that taxes are the reason, that we don't have a very high taxes on gas and oil in this country, and that's one of the reasons why it keeps our prices relatively low compared to the rest of the world. But does refining play a part in that? And if you can give us an idea of how much it possibly could save us in terms of our price at the pump. Tossing aside whether that's a good thing or bad thing.
The problem with oil is that it's getting more costly in every way. I've been focusing on the environmental and health costs. But, you know, burning 3 times as much fuel to refine a barrel and 3 times as much fuel to get that barrel out of the ground, if it's tar sands, is also more costly. Looking for it in, or if you prefer, ripping it off from other peoples in other countries and having to go to 5,000 feet deep in the middle of the Gulf of Mexico or off of Brazil, into parts of the Arctic where realistically everybody acknowledges the conditions are so extreme that if there's a spill, it can't be cleaned up, or to places like Iraq or Saudi Arabia or parts of Africa, where if you look at a map, that's where our military is, including Africa, and that's where our taxes are going. So I'm not a tax expert on the details, but I think it's obvious that in countries like Europe, more of the real costs of government support for fossil fuels are paid at the pump. In the United States, most of the real costs of our addiction to oil are paid through our income taxes. I don't think that I would I wouldn't acknowledge, because I don't think it's true, that we're taxed any less. But because those taxes are distributed in different ways, we may not see the real cost of our government support of our oil addiction at the gas pump as much as we would if we were buying gas in the UK, in France, in Germany, where their government policies are to tax it more transparently. And I think that these costs, of course, taxes are never totally efficient. And one of the things that happens when any resource becomes scarce or starts to become scarce, which is happening with oil, and then when other economies like China and India start to expand their automobile usage dramatically and demand for oil, a global commodity, goes up, it becomes more volatile. You see this with natural gas too. But with oil, the volatility results in more price spikes. People notice when the price goes up 50 cents, a dollar a gallon at the pump over the course of a few short months. And this is happening more and more often now. It's not just because we drive more in the summer. In fact, we've had price spikes in the winter lately. It's because the resource is becoming scarce. As it becomes scarce, it may be natural to have a knee-jerk reaction and say, what can we do about that? On the long term, the truth is that oil is becoming more costly, fossil fuels are becoming more costly in every way, and it is perhaps a survival issue long term, the question of how soon we recognize and address that by switching to a new energy source. All that said, on an incremental basis, the difference in cost, the dirtier oil is cheaper. A dollar a gallon or a dollar a barrel may be $5 a barrel cheaper to purchase. It's more expensive to process, but it's cheaper to purchase. Just taking that price spread on the crude itself, that translates to maybe a penny or 5 cents per gallon. So this isn't an issue of what consumers would see at the pump when our gasoline prices are ranging by a dollar a gallon or more from year to year. It's more an issue of the refinery's profit margin. A refinery can make millions of dollars of additional profit every month if it can find a way to so-called efficiently process cheaper, dirtier oil. That will boost the industry's profits. But this isn't an issue that's seen at the pump. This dirtier oil issue is really more an issue of reduced supply, incremental changes that maintain high profits for an industry that's highly subsidized, and frankly, more highly subsidized overall than alternative energy is.
And this didn't just spring up overnight. We'd been reading about this for close to a decade, that once oil hits around $80 to $100 a barrel, you're going to see it more cost-effective to try to harvest these dirtier sources of oil like the Alberta tar sands.
Yeah, I think, we're still sort of talking about this, trying to talk about this from the industry's perspective, and it's certainly more cost-effective or more profitable for them, for the industry to find the least cost way to make gasoline, and if they can get away with it, comes with a price tag of more emissions that can be externalized, that will boost their profits. That will help them keep a refinery in operation that might otherwise be marginal and close sooner. That externalizing those costs is part of the current situation.
Greg Karas, Senior Scientist for Communities for a Better Environment. Thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Tony Rice, Little Joe Blue, and Stevie Ray Vaughan. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Farm Fresh to You Organic Produce Delivery Service, connecting people to farms and leading the progressive change in America's food system. To learn more, go to farmfreshtoyou.com. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.